Okay. So just again, this screen, this is kind of the modern world, the world then, developing. I'm going to talk more about Media and Persia and then of course Greece and Rome tonight. I want you to turn in your Bible, to the book of Daniel. And, I want to just point out the transition that this prophet faced as he was in captivity, in the Babylonian captivity. Daniel chapter 6. And this is, well, let's look at Daniel 5, verses 30 and 31, where Belshazzar's doom, if you will, is sealed. This, of course, is Nebuchadnezzar's son. And we're going to look at some times here that are mentioned in the book of Daniel, just to kind of put a little bit of perspective on this. So, remember the handwriting on the wall. Daniel gives the interpretation, verses 25 and following. Basically, the kingdom is divided, verse 28. It's a very significant passage, historically. If you'll go back and do some research on that passage, you'll be surprised to see how divided and how tumultuous things were. What's interesting to me is the mindset of this son, Nebuchadnezzar's son, who is the king, and he's partying. He's having a good time. And he's certainly not concerned about the people or governing or being a good, righteous person, as is the case with so many of these dignitaries of this age. But nonetheless, even to our own day and age, you might start pointing your finger at people and say, you know, are they ruling for the people or ruling for themselves? So nonetheless, his doom is sealed, kingdom is divided. In verse 28, it's given to the Medes and the Persians. That's an interesting transition, historically speaking. Geographically speaking, verse 30 tells us this, tells of this happening. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans or Babylonians, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So about 62 years of age. And, you have a transition in the kingdom, in the empire. Go back to Daniel chapter 2. Remember, Daniel, the prophet, is experiencing all of this turmoil. Daniel chapter 2, in the interpretation of the dream in verse 31, the great image that Nebuchadnezzar had seen, a terrible image, a head with fine gold, breast and his arms of silver, thighs of brass, belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. And the interpretation of that great image is simply that this is an image of four different coming kingdoms. The present was Babylon. That gold, extravagant empire of Babylon. And then you have the, look at the verse 44 here. We'll talk about this in chapter 7 a little bit more. Well, let me back up here. Verse 36, this is the dream. We'll tell the interpretation. Verse 37, thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls, and so forth, hath he given, and hath made thee ruler over all them. Thou art this head of gold. That'd be Babylon. The image represented is Babylon by the head of gold. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. So this transition, if you will, the silver part of this image becomes the Medes and the Persians over here in chapter 5 and chapter 6. The Medes and the Persians assume authority and power. Today, we've talked about this before. Who is it in our world today that really considers themselves to be Persians? The Iranians. That's right. And so it's not coincidental, but right over in this area is Iran. And this is where the media and the Persians came out of. And very mountainous location. So they consider themselves ancient or old Persians. And having a deep root in that land, and that's their land, their right, and so forth. And, of course, they are Islamic, deeply entrenched in Islam. Okay, so then look at chapter 6, verse 1, and watch this. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. Daniel, a man of notoriety, an Israelite, who, like Joseph, rises to a very high place in this kingdom. Now, that's pretty significant. Last Sunday, we were talking, Mike Bonner and I, about some of these lessons we're learning. And one of the things that we want to remember is this. What happens here in captivity is impactful to the coming of Christ. For example, at the birth of Christ, do you remember do you remember wise men? You get caught up in culture, don't you? The wise men, do you remember where they came from? The East? Now, how did they know about this coming Messiah? Well, we don't know for sure. There was some special revelation that told them then, but they knew about it. They understood it. But the assumption is very simple. With Daniel the prophet and all these other prophets like Ezekiel in the captivity, who likely never came out of captivity, what are these guys doing like Daniel that are up to the levels of, you know, you got one of three under the Darius. What's this guy doing? He's having an impact. He's influencing. He's preaching the gospel, if you will, the gospel of Jesus that's coming. He hadn't come yet, but he's coming. So what's very strategic about this Bible geography is land, right? When we get to the book of Acts, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is God gave a great commission, the gospel, and he said to go into all the world. And sometimes perhaps we fail to think, or remember that the gospel of Jesus Christ has had impact, influence over the whole world for a long time. And in many ways, before even the coming of the Christ. By the captivities and things of this nature. And we have no idea how many other people spread out. And we're talking about Judaism, the Messiah. We don't know the answer to all that, but what we do know are little hints and bits and pieces of information that we read about, like the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4, who was pretty keen. A woman who knew that the Messiah would come. And so, this thing was being talked about. Now, this is a personal application segue. Today, I was sitting there at Lowe's and listening to these guys all tattooed up and, you know, pretty rough. And one was pretty real rough, and he was talking about sending one to see Jesus. They were kind of arguing. And he said, I'll take care of you right now and send you to see Jesus. Well, I'm sitting here thinking how popular, how predominant Jesus is. Now, I'm looking at these two cats and I'm going, you're nowhere near Jesus. You're so far from the kingdom, you need a lot of help. But this guy, you know, and they were kind of jesting. But what I'm getting at is that people talk about Jesus all the time. It's in their mind. Whether they live it out in their day. I heard a Tom T. Hall song. You remember this song? I think it's Tom T. Hall. Me and Jesus have our own thing going. Is that not Tom T. Hall? Who is that? Well, I just heard it on the radio. But my point is that me and Jesus got our own thing going. Well, that's not really true, is it? Jesus has his own thing going, and we're either on board with him collectively or not, you know. I mean, you may have an... Anyway, Point being is, we're not talking about something. I think sometimes we need to step out of our little box and realize the gospel of Jesus Christ, the God of heaven, the creator of the world, over all the world, all this land, has spoken loud and clear for generations, for millennia, about his son, about the cause of Christ, about redemption. And don't forget that. So, study it accurately. I go back to my Bible, right? Know it truthfully. Apply it intellectually and yet rightfully, with sincerity, and help people. That's our purpose in life. What other purpose do we have? You know, so again, Daniel here, in chapter 6, he's the first of these three princes, and he's in a very high position. Of course, in chapter 6, they conspire against him, and he's cast into the lion's den, but look at the end of the chapter. So look at verse 25. Then King Darius wrote unto all the people, nations, and languages. I mean, we got a king, a president, don't we? If he writes or says something, we're going to hear about it, right? Well, here's your king of this day and age, a dominant empire in the world then, and he's writing to all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth. There's your geography. Peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Now, isn't that amazing? Now, how big is our God? Well, he's bigger than Darius. But thanks, Darius, for helping us out and giving a decree to the known world then. So this message was not something, you know, who? Now watch it now. Here's an interesting transition. Look at Acts 17. That doesn't mean we don't have to do a lot of teaching to the pagans of the world and the people that are lost. But look at Acts 17 and verse 16. And you remember the story here while Paul waited for them, Silas and Timothy. He was in Athens, and Athens is in Greece, and we're not there yet. We're going to get there. His spirit was stirred because he saw the whole city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue of the Jews with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. Now he's in the synagogue in the Jews without devout people that are connected. That's an implication there of people that have authority or people that are able to influence and have an impact. And Paul is having that impact, preaching the gospel to them. Look what happens here, a city wholly given to idolatry. Nothing new here. The whole world's been given to idolatry. It's what we've been reading about throughout the whole Old Testament. And he's in the market daily, and he's disputing with the Epicureans, the Stoics, philosophers, who are encountering him. And some said, what will this babbler say? And this guy, he's a setter forth of strange gods. We've never heard of this one because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. Now, I make a point here on this as I kind of observe geography. Well, Greece is way over here and Italy's up in here, and you've got the Grecian Roman Empire, and you've got the Medes and the Persians over here. You know, the uttermost parts of the world in the book of Acts where Jesus said, you preach the gospel and you start in Jerusalem and you go to Samaria and then you go to the uttermost parts of the world, you stretch on out. Well, this right out here is very likely what we're talking about, because at the end of the book of Acts, geographically speaking, where do we end up? Paul is in He's got his own house, house arrest, but he's in Rome. And that's the uttermost parts of the world. This part of the world right here needed a lot of teaching. But this part of the world over here, I'm convinced, and even on down into Egypt, had a lot of gospel being preached to it before the Christ came by prophets, because we know Nahum the prophet, we know Jonah the prophet, we know Obadiah the prophet, and others that we likely don't know about were preaching. Here's another example. How many of the apostles do we know of where they went, what they did? Not everything, but how many of the 12 apostles do we know where they went and preached throughout the known world? They were under the Great Commission, right? And they were told to go into all the world to preach to every creature. So where'd Matthew go? Where'd Judas, not the one that betrayed the Lord, where did he go? Where'd Matthias go? Where'd the zealot go? Simon. Do we know? Biblically, we don't know. But did they go? You better believe they went. So, why did the Lord pick, by inspiration, the apostles he picked? You know? I don't know. But I know the Bible's sufficient. I'm not worried about it. It's all sufficient. Got everything I need to know, right? My point is, geographically speaking, God's been preaching the gospel through His people for a long time. Okay, so we got a transition here. Look at Daniel chapter 7. Now, look at the last passage in chapter 6 first, Daniel 6:28. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And guess what? That's all I know about Daniel. I don't know what happened to him. You go to the end of his prophecy in chapter 12, you get to verse 5, Daniel is told basically to seal up the books and all these things, the wonders that he had seen. And in verse 9, Daniel 12, verse 9, God said, "Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly." You know, isn't that the lesson we're basically told? You do your part. You be faithful until the end. Many will prosper. You know, few there be that find it. But the wicked, they're going to do wickedly. Don't sit around and question that. You know, we spend a lot of time wondering, don't we? Why the world, why? Why do we do that? That's a big enough job trying to take care of myself and making sure I stay focused. Isn't it? There's your answer right there. It's a focus issue. Just distracted. I don't know what else to tell you. Pleasures of sin. Move on. Preach the gospel. You know, with kindness. I don't mean unkindly. But nonetheless, they're going to do wickedly. And from that time, verse 11, the daily sacrifices shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up. There shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 days. But go thou thy way till the end, Daniel. That's talking about the coming of Christ. And for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. Now, that's a reference to, I believe, the judgment. Daniel, you've done a good job. Now, Daniel very likely died over here in Persia or in that Median Persia transition. Now, back to chapter 7, you have reference here to, again, the vision of four beasts during Belshazzar, the son of Nebuchadnezzar. And he gives you a timeline in the first year of his reign after his dad Nebuchadnezzar. Another dream and vision of his head upon his bed. And Daniel spake and said, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another." And he gives again. The first was like a lion, Babylon. The second, verse 5, the Persians, like a bear. The Greeks, verse 6, like a leopard. And then the Romans, fourth beast, in verse 7, dreadful and terrible. Dreadful and terrible. And I want you to realize something you likely already know. But we still to this day are still in many ways under a Roman type of principle and rule, civilly speaking. For example, I wrote some notes down. You ever heard of the 12 tables talking about justice and jurisdiction? And have you ever heard about corpus juris civilis? Have you ever heard about subpoena, habeas corpus? You ever heard about pro bono, affidavit? You ever heard of those things? Those are all derived from Roman rule, Roman law. And we still use those concepts and principles, don't we? Because of the civility, the nature of Roman rule was very logical. Very logical. Based upon a very core principle that, like we talked about last Sunday, a common good that existed amongst all human beings. People need to be governed and ruled, but there needs to be a sense of freedom too. And the struggle was real between the tyrants, the tyranny of the empire, the emperors, who were deified. And so, at the same time, they had a sense of civility. They had courts, they had rule, they had, when we get to the Apostle Paul, who is also a Roman citizen. And he knows Roman language and he knows Hebrew language and he can play both ends there. He looks over there at the foolishness going on amongst the Jews and he sees that Roman soldier, he sees that Roman dignitary sitting there and he says, I appeal to... And that was a legal right. And if you forfeit that right, if you didn't give him that right, that was a bad deal. Just like today. Innocent until proven. How many cases have been turned over because of the mishandling, especially lately? And I'm not talking about the corruption. I'm talking about just, simply put, because of the mishandling of situations, because of rule and law. All right? So some of the things we want to think about here. So Daniel goes through this transition. I won't spend much more time there in Daniel. I'm tempted to talk more about some of that, but let's go ahead and fast track through some of this. We talked about the captivity of Judah, talked about the 70 years of Babylonian captivity. Daniel comes out of this. He's now in the Medo-Persians, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Queen Esther. She rises. Another interesting story. Who is Esther? Who is she married to? What kind of an influence does she have upon the world, geographically speaking? All right, so there's your prophets again. I know that this is review, but just for your benefit, if you want to remind me later or talk to me about some of that. The kings here that are gone, at the end of this captivity, here's another point to consider. When God's people are restored back to the land after the 70 years, who's the next king? That's kind of a trick question. Who do they appoint to be king over the kingdom in Israel? Trick question. You can take a stab at it, or I'm going to go and keep talking. No. That's all right. No, there was none, really. There never was a King Herod. But was he their king? But he wanted to be a king. He was related to him. How'd you mean? King, related to the Ishmaelites and the Edomites. Jesus. This is it right here. This is an end period. Going back to the Old Testament, God said, you're going to pick a king, and I'm going to give you a king, and he's going to be hard on you. And they got all those kings, and you wonder, did they get it out of their system? I don't know. Another... They weren't looking. So when Christ shows up, here's your king. What's nailed across or above the cross there when he's nailed to the cross? The Romans, old Pontius Pilate made sure they got their king. Boy, that was made them mad. Jesus, of course, answered Pontius Pilate. You remember in John 18:36, he said, Thou sayest that I am a king, and for this reason I came. My kingdom is not of this world, spiritual kingdom. For if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight physically. But yet Jesus commissioned us to fight spiritually. Fight spiritually. So, just an interesting transition. No more kings. So my question again for Judaism today and modern day Jews, if they were to establish Judaism, they're going to go back to their Old Testament Hebrew scriptures. Don't call it old. It's Hebrew to them. That's their Hebrew scriptures, not old. They're still under that. So are you going to set up another king? Who's going to be your new king? No, we don't want a king anymore. You want a judge? No, we don't want a judge anymore. You want the tribe of Judah to oversee? Oh, we don't know who the tribe of Judah is anymore. Because they've been so dispersed and split up and divided throughout the ages. The point is, historically, geographically speaking, what has God been doing to the nation of Israel all this time? He's been making them focus on something that they haven't focused upon. Unfortunately, just like us today, we like to focus upon land, things physical, right? I'm not saying you can't fight for your property lines and shouldn't, stand up. That's not what I'm talking about, but I am talking about focus, and I'm talking about what we center our attention upon. So by the time we get to Rome, you think the Romans are going to give it all back to them and let them try to go back and repeat all their history over again and say, here, try again. You did such a wonderful job before. Here, try again. It wasn't going to happen. And God knew that. We talked about this last Sunday, the roads, and hear how they built roads. And you've got this these markers that were along the way. And all these markers announced that you'd get back to Rome. This road will get you back to Rome. There were markers. This is what they built. And we ended on this right here. I realize that we're on the same slide. But the it's pretty interesting. The roads were clearly marked with milestones from the eternal city. Again, you can see the paganism, or you can see the bad reasoning. No pilgrim or merchant could ever forget that he journeyed upon an imperial road. Roman mile was 1,500 meters. I want to talk about this, and then I'm going to try to wrap it up on the study of Rome. I want to show you something real quick in Galatians 4. Look at Galatians chapter 4 for just a moment. And remember, so you never question the absoluteness of the gospel in the day and age you live in. What does Galatians chapter 4 verse 4 say about Jesus and when he came? Was it an accident? When Jesus was born of a virgin, at that time, during that time, did it happen just coincidentally? So that 2,000 years later, atheists could say, it's just a coincidence. In the fullness of time, what does that mean? Just as Daniel prophesied and gave the interpretation to the dream, in the days of these kings, the Romans, God would set up what? A kingdom. Now, setting it up doesn't mean it didn't already exist in God's mind and in the full establishment of it. It was still developed. It's an eternal kingdom. But the organization with Christ being crucified, all this happened in the fullness of time. And that passage stands out because of what we need to really, I think, dig into a little more, the Romans, the Roman Empire, the Roman society. I want to talk to you a little bit about 10 things that made Rome great. Now, I got this from a different